This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, legendary lawyer Michael Tiger joins us to discuss his new book, Sensing Injustice, A Lawyer's Life in the Battle for Change.
We spend the hour with Michael Tiger. This is a terrific book, Sensing Injustice, and a terrific interview. Listen in.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
We're going to spend the entire hour with attorney Michael Tiger to discuss his just published magnificent memoir, Sensing Injustice, A Lawyer's Life in the Battle for Change. By the time he was 26, Michael Tiger was a legend in legal circles, well before he would take on some of the highest profile cases of his generation. In his first U.S. Supreme Court case at the age of 28, Tiger won a unanimous victory that freed thousands of Vietnam War resistors from prison. Tiger also led the legal team that secured a judgment against the Chilean Pinochet regime for the 1976 murders of dictator Pinochet's opponent Orlando Letelier and his colleague Ronnie Moffitt in a Washington, D.C. car bombing. He then worked with the lawyers who prosecuted Pinochet for torture and genocide. A relentless fighter of injustice, Tiger has been counsel for Angela Davis, Jamal Abdullah Al-Aman, H.R.A.P. Brown, the Chicago 8, and leaders of the Black Panther Party, to name only a few. His book is about stories, people's stories of injustice, struggle, and sometimes vindication, as he puts it. Michael Tiger is a magnificent storyteller with a dry wit and a prodigious memory. Tiger has written or edited 15 books and has argued 7 cases before the U.S. Supreme Court and over 100 in the U.S. Court of Appeals. He's worked for over 50 years with movements for social change as a human rights lawyer, a law professor, and a writer. Michael Tiger, congratulations and welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Michael, yours is a book about people's stories. Let's talk first about yours. You write that, quote, we acquire our consciousness from observation and sensation in the social, cultural, and political setting in which we grow up. Please talk about the social, cultural, and political setting in the 50s and 60s at the University of California, Berkeley, where you went to college and law school.
Well, sure. I arrived at Berkeley in 1958, so I'm 80 years old now. For the first, up to the seventh grade, we lived in Glendale, California, which was a sundown community. No blacks could be in the city overnight. Our municipal pool was segregated. As a paper boy, delivering papers around to places, I would deliver to the housing projects and people in different neighborhoods. My mother spoke Spanish, and we would go shopping in the barrio. And so that was sort of an introduction. And then when I was an adolescent, I got interested in issues of social justice. I read voraciously. And so there I was at Berkeley. But when I got there in 58, it's important to know there was already a movement against racism, particularly in housing. Then there was concern about the farm workers just beginning to organize. There was concern about nuclear disarmament and sort of impending maybe a conflict in Southeast Asia where the United States might be taking over France's role. And all of these things were boiling around and became part of what students wanted to talk about. And then, of course, as we know, the administration of the university cracked down, and eventually that led to the free speech movement in 1964. So that was the atmosphere. For a kid from the San Fernando Valley in Glendale, California, it was eye-opening.
I can only imagine, Michael. I was a kid from a little village north of Milwaukee, and when I got to the University of Wisconsin, which was on a parallel track with Berkeley, it was eye-opening for me. Talk about, would you please, why you decided to take up the challenges of being a lawyer? And particularly, would you mention the impact of your reading Irving Stone's biography of Clarence Darrow called Attorney for the Damned when you were a teenager? I read it too, and I was wondering what your reaction was to that. But more generally, can you talk about how you decided to become a lawyer?
Well, by the time I was graduated from high school, I knew I wanted to become a lawyer. I had become interested in the issues of capital punishment and had read Arthur Koestler's wonderful book, Reflections on Hanging. When I was just entering my teens, my father, I said, gee, Dad, I want to be a lawyer. And he told me, he said, no, here's a book. And an Irving Stone book is called Clarence Darrow for the Defense. And he gave it to me. He said, this is the kind of lawyer you ought to be. He was for the people. And so that summer, I can remember, I went to the bookstore in Reseda and got every book about Clarence Darrow that I could, and I read them all. So I was prepared to take a look at a career in the law. And of course, Darrow's talking about the issues that he had confronted in his practice just whetted my appetite. Now, you mentioned Attorney for the Damned. That was the Weinberg book, a collection of Darrow's jury arguments and such. And I bought a copy of that in 1958 when I first got to Berkeley. I saw it in the bookstore, and I spent more money than I should have to have it.
As a young attorney, Michael, you were involved in support in the anti-Vietnam War movement by representing young men who resisted the draft. Can you please talk about the Gutknecht case?
Yes, David Gutknecht. That's what we opened the book with. But in 1967, I started practicing law in Washington, D.C. And the draft calls were going up and up and up as more and more young men were being shipped off to fight this war in Vietnam. The selective service system hardly merited the name system. Local draft boards did whatever the hell they wanted to. There was discrimination against African American and Hispanic draft registrants and against those who wanted to claim conscientious objector status. And so a small group of us in Washington got together and said, we need to have a publication to help people be lawyers for draft registrants and draft counselors. And over the next 6 months to a year, I wrote the book part, that is, how to represent registrants. Our publication, Selective Service Law Reporter, included all the cases that were being decided and the regulations and so on. So I finished writing the book, and I get a call from the ACLU. The Supreme Court has decided to take up the question of the draft delinquency regulations. Now, these regulations were Selective Service's answer to draft protests where registrants would turn in or burn their draft cards. Rather than give them trials where they'd have a little due process, the local draft board simply revoked their exemptions and deferments, such as their student deferment, and ordered them to report for induction immediately. Well, 30,000 of young men that were in this spot had simply refused induction when the time came and thus faced prosecution. So the Supreme Court decided to look into the legality of these regulations that stripped young men of their deferments. And the ACLU called me up and said, well, you think you're so smart. Would you write the brief and argue the case? So I was only 28 years old. And I said, well, no, I'm not a member of the Supreme Court Bar. I'm not eligible. I haven't been a lawyer long enough. He said, we'll make a motion. We'll get that done. And so there it is at the age of 29. I argued before the Supreme Court of the United States. And we won 9-0. And the great thing about it is that things were beginning to change. Because when the government got ready to write its brief, the then Solicitor General of the United States, Irwin Griswold, refused to sign the government's brief because he thought that the regulations were no good. And so Nixon sent the Johnson administration, they sent some hapless lawyer from the DOJ, William Ruckelshaus, to argue the case instead. And if you read in the book, you'll see that that's one of the things that happened very soon, very quickly into the argument, is that Justice Douglas wanted to know why the Solicitor General had refused to sign the government's brief. And Solicitor General Griswold sat in the spectator section looking opprobrious about the government's position. It was wonderful drama.
We're speaking with Michael Tiger, whose just published memoir, Sensing Injustice, A Lawyer's Life in the Battle for Change. It's just a terrific book. Michael, you've got so much information in the book that I'm totally absorbed in it. So is Heidi. But I wanted to ask you about the trial of the Chicago 7 movie. A lot of our listeners have seen Alan Sorkin's movie, and I know that you were involved in the case. Could you tell us a little bit about your involvement and the significance of the case overall?
Sure. I mean, I'm not in the movie. I got airbrushed out. But as a result of the protests, massive protests, in 1968, the Congress passed the Rapp-Brown Act, and that was the statute under which the Chicago defendants were prosecuted. It was, you know, traveling in interstate commerce with the intent to participate in a riot. Well, I drafted most of the pretrial motions in the case dealing with the constitutionality of the statute and so on. And then, for the first time, the government filed a paper, and I can remember it, summer of 69, revealing that they had wiretaps of these defendants based on national security, and therefore that they didn't have warrants for them. So with Dennis Roberts' help, we briefed, and then I argued that that issue as well. Well, I'd signed on only to be a lawyer in the pretrial phase of the case. And then just on the eve of trial, Charlie Gary, who was Bobby Seale's lawyer, had to have surgery, and so they asked for a continuance. Judge Hoffman said, no continuance, you're going to trial. And Seale said, well, I won't have the lawyer of my choice. And Hoffman said, I got an idea. The lawyers that argued the pretrial motions, they'll be your lawyer. And Seale said, well, I didn't want them to be my lawyer. Well, I got a call saying Hoffman has ordered you to appear in Chicago. I'd started teaching at UCLA. And I said, well, I'm not going to go to Chicago and participate in a charade that Bobby Seale has counseled his choice. Well, the next thing I know, I've been arrested. Hoffman had issued a bench warrant for my arrest, and I was taken under guard to in a flight to Chicago. You really don't know what it's like to be traveling with two marshals. You've got the middle seat. Every time you want to take a pee, the marshal has to go in with you to make sure you're not going to escape through the toilet. And I got to Chicago early in the morning, and I'm in a cell. And the great thing was I got to spend a whole day in jail with Bobby Seale. Law professors came and picketed the courthouse. Hoffman eventually withdrew the contempt citation. The Court of Appeals let us out on bail even before that happened. And, there it was. But the legal issues remain to this day. Now I'm going to tell you a story that's not in the book because it didn't happen yet. We briefed and said the Rapp-Brown Act was unconstitutional as violating the First Amendment. And we briefed it also in the Court of Appeals. The United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit just held about 2 weeks ago that the Rapp-Brown Act is indeed unconstitutional, most of it. And the panel in the Ninth Circuit was two Court of Appeals judges and one United States District Judge sitting by designation. That judge was John Tiger.
Tell us John Tiger. Yes, yeah, that's wonderful.
During the Vietnam War, as most listeners know, Daniel Ellsberg was working at a Defense Department think tank, the RAND Corporation. He stole the Pentagon papers and gave them to a number of media outlets, including the New York Times. The Nixon administration tried to restrain publications but failed. Now, 10 years ago, Julian Assange also embarrassed the government by publishing what's become known as the Iraq War Logs, which, among other things, show American soldiers committing a war crime. The Trump administration, ignoring the Supreme Court's ruling in the Pentagon Papers case, went ahead and indicted Julian Assange on charges of espionage. So far, the Biden administration is continuing to pursue Assange. What is your evaluation of the import of this case?
Well, the Assange case is important, first of all, for a reason we didn't predict was going to happen, and that is that the extradition has been refused by the United Kingdom judge because of the deplorable conditions under which people are held in U.S. prisons. That is a first. But underlying this, of course, is the Pentagon Papers issue. And the key to this is this, that what Assange revealed, and he is a journalist, there's no question about that. WikiLeaks is a journalistic outfit. What they revealed is are crimes committed by the United States and United States forces. And whenever somebody reveals so-called secrets that have to do with government illegality, we get this kind of pushback. And even under the Obama administration, that sort of attack on journalists continued. The key here is that in a trial of someone like Assange, if he were to be returned to the United States, the government would be trumpeting the classified nature of all of these things that were revealed, when in fact, the defendant has no right to challenge the legitimacy of the classification. The jury is just told the documents are classified. Now, what's wrong with that? Well, the Congress has passed a statute called the Overclassification Act, which ought to give you a hint that there's a problem there. You mentioned the Pentagon Papers. Solicitor General Griswold went to argue in the Supreme Court about suppressing them. He asked that all 47 volumes be delivered to his office. He read all 47 volumes, and he could only find 11 instances in which there was something arguably properly subject to classification in all 47 volumes. So what we have here is the deployment of factitious arguments about national security in support of suppression of information about things that everybody ought to know about. And I'll give you a little example. I've been representing, along with students and lawyers from four or five countries, the people of the Chagos Archipelago, kicked off their island home of Diego Garcia to build the military base. The United Kingdom argued in the English House of Lords that they needed to keep all the Chagosians from ever returning to their homeland because they were needed to preserve the environment of this archipelago. Well, a British diplomat wrote to his U.S. counterpart in a secret document saying, this environmental thing is just a hoax we're trying to perpetrate on the House of Lords, and we hope we get away with it, essentially. Well, WikiLeaks disclosed that cable, which has been very important in the subsequent litigation, and shows the extent to which secrecy is administered in an improper way. We got hold of the document because WikiLeaks had revealed it, and my students filed a Freedom of Information request saying, here's a document. You've got one like this in your files. Please give it to us. And the government wrote back and said, yes, we do have one exactly like this in our files, so it is authentic, but we can't give it to you because it's still a secret. And which I think goes into a category called government think. So I am disappointed in the Biden administration because ever since the dawn of the Republic, the idea of public information about what officials do has been an extremely important part of what passes for representative democracy.
The government was able to whip up anti-communist hysteria during the witch hunt of the 50s and was able to get Julius and Ethel Rosenberg condemned to death. The trial took place in the same building where you so skillfully defended Lynn Stewart. Just like Trump, when he got elected, he decided to go after Julian Assange. When Bush got elected, he decided to go after Lynn Stewart to make an example out of her. You defended her and got her a light sentence, which was later overturned. Talk about the political nature of her trial and the political trials in general, please.
Well, Lynn Stewart, a courageous lawyer, had represented Sheikh Abdul Rahman in his criminal trial and thereafter tried to improve his prison conditions. She was charged with having broadcast to the media various views that he had about political topics that were important. Now, the trial, which took 9 months, by the way, took quite a toll on everybody, and it's true that we lost it to the jury, but the judge kind of got the point of it and did administer a light sentence, although that was later overturned. The the ferocity of the government with respect to Lynn Stewart, who simply wanted the truth about what was happening in the Middle East to come out, and who wanted faithfully to represent her client, who was also interested in that. Quite remarkable. There were 88,000 intercepts by government wiretaps and overhearings, all done under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which they could use because they had some defendants, potential defendants, who were not citizens. Those 88,000 intercepts then were mishandled by the FBI, so we never could get a true picture of exactly what was going on. She was yoked for trial with other defendants, put together with other defendants, so that her individual case could not receive the kind of attention that it should. And there we were. You talk about trying it in that building. We were trying it in that building in the shadow of what would have been the World Trade Center buildings if they had not been knocked down. We had an anonymous jury. The jurors were held under very tight security, brought to court in sealed buses. The whole atmosphere of the case was designed to enhance the government's contention that serious national security stuff was going on here. And I'll tell you something else. Ramsey Clark came forward in sentencing and revealed that he had done exactly the same conduct with which Lynn was charged. But, I mean, he was a male and he was a person with a certain reputation, and so the government didn't go after him. They tried to single out Lynn and to punish her.
In your wonderful book, you quote Justice Brandeis, "If the government becomes lawbreakers, it breeds contempt for the law." And you say that you think the government is the most dangerous criminal and also a recidivist. Can you elaborate on that and then talk briefly about the Demjanjuk case?
Yes, well, yes, we do quote Justice Brandeis, and the fact is the government is a recidivist. It has more power to do wrong than any private individual could possibly have. So when it destroys relevant information, denies people trials, and so on, there's a lot of power behind that. Now, I got appointed by the court, asked by the court to represent John Demjanjuk, who at that time was in Israel. He'd been sentenced to death as having been Ivan the Terrible of Treblinka, the ghastly concentration camp guard. However, evidence had come to light that the government knew that he was not Ivan the Terrible of Treblinka, that in fact it was somebody else entirely. And the Israeli Supreme Court was considering that issue. The Sixth Circuit decided to look into the question of whether the courts of the United States had been misled. I was hesitant about the case because I didn't want to be, you know, yoked with any Holocaust deniers, but this defense was not about that. And in fact, we had 2 years of hearings in different places, and finally the Court of Appeals held that indeed the United States government had committed fraud on the courts, and they had fraudulently sent this man to Israel to face a death sentence. And when I met him, he was in a death cell in Israel, knowing that, in fact, he was innocent of those charges. The Israeli Supreme Court acquitted him, which, you know, I think that'll give you some idea that there was no evidence. After the Israeli Supreme Court acquitted him, we wanted to get him back to the United States. And the United States government took the position that he couldn't come back to the United States, that they should send him to the Ukraine and maybe the Ukrainians would shoot him. Well, the Sixth Circuit held that he had the right to come back to the United States and that the United States government should not interfere with that. I don't want to take up a lot of time. There's a great story about oral argument in the Sixth Circuit that day. I'm sitting waiting to argue, and the government lawyer is sitting there, Doug Wilson, and a media person says, "Oh, Doug, do you think this case will get a decision today?" And Wilson says, "Well, I don't know if we will. I think probably because Chief Judge Merritt wants to see his kisser on the national television." And a woman in the front row turns around and said, "Excuse me, Chief Judge Merritt is my husband, and I don't think he's going to like it when I tell him what you said." So there's a moral in there for lawyers waiting to have your case called, and that is just shut the hell up and read your notes.
We're speaking with Michael Tiger, his just published wonderful memoir called Sensing Injustice, A Lawyer's Life in the Battle for Change, just came out. You can get it at monthlyreview.org. Just go online, monthlyreview.org, one word, monthlyreview.org, and you'll get the book. Michael, I wanted to ask you, before I ask you a substantive question, I wanted to ask you about the ebook that you get for free when you order it from Monthly Review.
Absolutely. Monthlyreview.org. Order it from them, because what we did, and I had a great research assistant, Jenna Waldman, and if you get the ebook, it means that, for instance, if you're interested in the oral argument I made in the Jemanu case, you can go to the notes and sources and click on a URL and listen to it. You can listen to the oral arguments in the Supreme Court. You can read the briefs that were filed. You can look at these media sources, which, by the way, there's a lot in the book about that I hadn't known before, about my father's battle against racism in the Machinist Union. So, you know, primary sources from 80 years ago. So the Monthly Review deal is a great deal for those of you interested in maybe tracking back on these things.
Michael, I'm going to ask you again how to get the book when we conclude our interview, but let's proceed. I wanted to know what remedy do we have when the executive branch of the government violates the Constitution. Is it more difficult to do this now than in decades in the past?
It comes and goes. But if you look at, just look at the voting patterns of judges that were appointed by the Trump administration, for example, or by Bush 1, there's a lot of studies about the ideological impact, particularly in the United States Courts of Appeals. And so, yes, we can expect judges that are less inclined to do the job that Article 3 of the Constitution assigns to them in these times. I don't want to say that it's all hopeless and all the judges that are appointed by a particular president take a view. We have the example of Justice Blackmun and Justice Souter, for example, Justice Kennedy, all appointed by Republican presidents, and the job that they did. But yes, I think that it's more difficult than it was 10 years ago, although in cases involving racism, the great upsurge, all of the street demonstrations and so on, are sensitizing judges and making them realize that the courts have a job to do.
Michael, dovetailing with that, you write, quote, "You cannot count on the government to do its job when that job involves acting on behalf of people's rights." Why do you say it must come from a popular movement?
Well, that's because that's a lesson we've learned at great cost to ourselves. The Supreme Court decides Brown versus Board of Education in 1954, and standing in the foyers were 10,000 lawyers, all of them racist and all of them willing for a fee to block the effect of Brown v. Board with all of the suits that were filed. And finally, in 1960, February 1st, people are tired. And up the street from where I sit in Greensboro, North Carolina, the sit-in direct action movement began. And you look at the next years, 61, 62, 63, 64, the people took to the streets to demand that the promise of Brown be redeemed, to demand that the promise of the 14th Amendment itself be redeemed, a promise without the keeping of which Abraham Lincoln said we were not entitled to call ourselves a nation state. And it was that did two things. First of all, it caused this pressure for change. Second, of course, it provoked the reactionaries to pass statutes like the Rap Brown Law so that the lawyers' role changed. It was no longer filing the suit to desegregate the schools. It was to defend the mass demonstration and to enforce the First Amendment right to protest. And so what illustrates is, first of all, you couldn't count on the courts to get the job done, until they were alerted, perhaps, to the issues that were involved by what happened in the streets. Second, that the task of lawyers was not all done when you'd filed your latest lawsuit for affirmative relief. And third, that the lawyer's task was defined not by some historical Supreme Court agenda, but by the needs of the people's movement.
Michael, when you were a young lawyer, you took a job with Edward Bennett Williams, who was a great trial lawyer. I wanted to ask you about the oral argument that he made in the Alderman and Havana cases, which you mentioned in the book. You highlight how Williams addresses the issue of national security interests versus the Fourth Amendment. Could you please discuss that and talk a little bit about Edward Bennett Williams?
Well, I went to work for Edward Bennett Williams in 1966. Much of the book is about him. If you want to read more of his oral arguments and cross-examinations, I wrote another book called Persuasion, The Litigator's Art. But the Alderman and Ivanov case involved in part wiretaps in which a Soviet citizen, Igor Ivanov, who was later captured in an espionage case, had been overheard. And so one question was there an exception to the Fourth Amendment for national security cases? Two brilliant pieces of Williams' argument in the Supreme Court were this. First, Justice Harlan said, well, Mr. Williams, you realize, of course, that if your argument is accepted here, a spy will go free. And Williams said, well, I think you have to recognize that espionage has the lowest recidivism rate of any federal felony, which I thought was, I mean, for an offhand remark, was great. And the other thing he said, and I'm just paraphrasing now from memory, is, you know, he said, I yield to no one in my regard for what the executive branch wants to do. He said, we're not, if they want to lie, cheat, steal, commit burglary or mayhem, well, fine, well and good. But I have always thought that a federal court sitting in a criminal matter was a kind of sanctuary in the jungle. And that, yes, it's a concept I stole from him, which always, as you know, we lawyers do. We just steal things from other lawyers. And I use that effectively, I think, in the Nichols case.
Michael, can you talk a bit about the David Chuang case and how the Carter administration used it to reassert a national security agenda that had been discredited during Nixon's administration?
He was prosecuted for espionage because he had a friend in the State Department, Ronald Humphrey, reveal diplomatic cables, diplomatic chit-chat, as our expert witness Morton Alpert said, that had to do with the United States policy towards Vietnam in the wake of the Vietnam War. And it was important that this kind of information get out because even though the war was over, the aftermath was still being played out, and the question of U.S. policy towards Vietnam was still very important. But the Carter administration undertook this prosecution of David, and it not only did it charge him with espionage, but it conducted the trial in an outrageously unfair way. There was warrantless wiretapping, warrantless electronic surveillance. Every day it turned out that the CIA was preventing the prosecutors from turning over to us information we needed to cross-examine witnesses. The case went up to the Fourth Circuit, back down to the trial court as we explored these issues. And so eventually David's conviction was upheld, but in the meantime, we exposed an operation that was designed to discredit those who were seeking to normalize relations with Vietnam in that post-war period. And although David was sentenced, the sentence was, I think, a great deal lighter than it would have been had we not raised and litigated these issues.
Michael Tiger, you write about the death penalty, that it doesn't deter crime. And I was especially alarmed by the spree that the Trump administration went on before he left office of executing so many people. You argue that the death penalty is racist, that it's, death is final, that mistakes are made, that the United States still has the death penalty. And I wanted to get your opinion on what it's going to take to get rid of it.
Michael, Heidi, we know that Virginia just abolished it. And what we're seeing over the years is a dramatic decrease in the number of death verdicts that jurors are handing down because, A, these cases are being effectively tried by lawyers, and mitigation evidence is freely admitted and jurors take it into account. Jurors are also seeing these results of wrongful convictions and people being exonerated, so they're unsure about whether or not such a final kind of a punishment is appropriate. Those things are undermining the death penalty and are steps towards abolishing it. With respect to the Trump administration, yes, it is racist. And in the book, click on the case of Orlando Hall. For 30 years, I worked with lawyers, Rob Owen and others, and in Orlando was convicted in federal court in Fort Worth. He had monstrously ineffective assistance of counsel. And we took the case to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, which enforces the Inter-American Treaty. I was the expert witness on the right to counsel under international law. And then last year, the commission issued a decision that documented the racism in the death penalty, not just in Orlando's case, but throughout the system in the United States. Just one more instance of documenting that. That decision, the Inter-American Court, was sent to the Trump administration, Secretary Pompeo, and of course to Attorney General Barr. And that's what rankles. Rather than give the decision the credit to which it is entitled under the international law, they went ahead and prioritized Orlando for execution and killed him in deliberate violation of the order of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. So I feel that, personally, but I also feel that this campaign against the death penalty, that there are things we can do. My daughter, Catherine McQueen, is a physician. She testifies as a mitigation witness in capital cases on issues of substance abuse and addiction. She's been successful in more than half the cases, getting juries to vote for life. So there's a job to do, and it can be done.
Michael, turning to another case, can you please talk about the assassination of Orlando Letelier and Ronnie Moffitt and what you were able to do to bring dictator Augusto Pinochet to justice?
Well, on September the 21st, 1976, agents of the Pinochet regime assassinated Orlando Letelier, who had been Minister of Justice in the Allende government, and Ronnie Moffitt by blowing them up as their car went around Sheridan Circle in Washington. My partner Sam Buffone and I sued the Republic of Chile, and we got a judgment for the murders of Orlando and Ronnie, which eventually we collected $4 million for the widow Isabel Letelier, for the Moffitt family, and for the children. Juan Pablo Letelier, Orlando's son, is today a senator in Chile, and another of his sons, Francisco, is a great artist. But we went on beyond that. In 1998, using the results of that case, a Spanish court issued a warrant, and Pinochet was arrested in London. I got a call, my wife Jane and I did, and we went to London and helped with the extradition case. Eventually, Pinochet was allowed to go back to Chile, but by that time, what had happened had taken the edge off, and the Chilean courts began to look into these abuses. So in another chapter, some students of ours and I, along with a lawyer in Madrid, Juan Garces, represented the widow of a man who had been killed in Santiago during the coup, the Pinochet coup. And the killer was the same guy who had killed Orlando and Ronnie. So we wanted the Chilean government to get Michael Vernon Townley, this killer, extradited from the United States back to Chile to stand trial for this 1973 murder. I went to argue in the Chilean Supreme Court. I actually only said 10 words because my Spanish wasn't good enough, but fortunately there were other lawyers that spoke it better. And the justice, the single justice, said, well, we can't do it because Pinochet gave an amnesty to everybody who'd committed any murders on behalf of his government. I said the amnesty was invalid, but the justice said, no, it's not. So my students looked up the statute in Chile. It turns out there's a crime called illicit association, which is banding together to commit criminal acts. And there was no amnesty for that. The Chilean Supreme Court then held 3 years ago that the entire Pinochet secret police force was an illicit association within the meaning of the statute. And now it's open in Chile to prosecute those people and to bring them to justice in civil courts. So I tell the story at length in the book, and I don't want to take too much time with it now, but this just shows you that, you know, these cases are not over in a minute. Somebody comes up with an idea, and we push it forward and push it forward, and maybe we get something done.
I met Ann Fagan Ginger back in 1965 when I was working out in Oakland as a law clerk. Had dinner at her house. She took me around the Alexander Micklejohn Library, which was in her backyard. Then later on, Heidi worked with Ann when she was the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild. I know that you worked with her, too, and we wanted to take a moment for you to ask you how you describe her contribution to the legal field.
Incalculable. Probably when you went to dinner at her house, I was hiding back in the stacks back there somewhere. I got to law school in 1963. I took a semester off between college, or a year off between college and law school, to be a reporter for Pacifica Radio, by the way, which then at that time, WBAI was a part of it. I learned a lot working at Pacifica Radio, first as a volunteer and then as a correspondent, about communication, about writing skills. But then when I got to law school, I got a job with Ann Ginger. And she was collecting cases and briefs and pleadings from civil rights cases going on all over the country. And you can just imagine what was going on then. And we would digest those, and she'd put them in the civil liberties docket. So I got two things. First of all, I got to see law as it was. That the law is not what it says, but what it does, as Jerome Frank said. And I could see it happening in these cases. And second, I learned from Ann this incalculably valuable skill of how to write things out clearly, how to summarize, how to see the issues and to list them and isolate them and so on. Ann's contributions to our understanding of the law, the civil rights, civil liberties, international law, we could go on about for hours. But for me, the enduring value is one that I recognize every day when I try to be a good communicator about the issues that we're talking about today. So, yes, I share your regard for Ann and the contribution she made.
We'd love to hear what you think each of us, including law students, legal workers, and young lawyers, how we can be most useful and effectively participate in tackling the many issues of the day.
The book is called Sensing Injustice. You know, you can be aware of what's going on around you. In every community all across the country, there are these injustices, and you know what? There are lawyers that are working on them. There are clinical programs in the law school that you might be attending or planning to attend. If you're a practicing lawyer, there are opportunities for you to get involved in these cases by searching out the National Lawyers Guild in your community, by searching out capital defense organizations in your community. It just takes a little energy and listening and looking to the movements for change and trying to figure out how to get involved with them. That's a sign of a vague recitation. But then again, maybe you could read the whole book and look at what all of the lucky things that have happened to me. You know, every time I turned around, once I developed a sense of, gee, you know, there's an injustice over there. I wonder if something could be done about it. If that's the questions you ask yourself every morning, you'll be just fine.
I love reading your book, Michael, and I would urge people to go out and get it, Sensing Injustice. How can people get it? Can you talk about that and talk about the special features of the e-book?
Right. You can order it through Amazon if you want Jeff Bezos to have more money to crush labor unions. But if you don't, then go to monthlyreview.org and go to books or bookstore and look at the offer there. You can get a copy of the book, and then the e-book comes with it, which will help you to use the URLs to get at the primary sources. My research assistant Jenna Waldman and I managed to cobble together as source material for this book to help you follow down issues that you might be interested in. So that's the way to do it.
Michael, would you mind reading one of your favorite passages from the book for us?
Not at all. This is from near the end. In early 1989, Justice Brennan asked me to help him write his remarks for the dedication of the Edward Bennett Williams Law Library at Georgetown Law School. I came to Washington, and we sat in Brennan's office, poring over transcript of Ed's Supreme Court arguments and sharing stories about him. As I was leaving, Brennan took hold of my arm and asked, "Did I do any good up here?" I said yes, as meaningfully as I could. So I thought, all of us who have a sense of purpose are likely to have doubts about the worth of our work. The doubt is healthy. If you desire social change and want to assist its arrival, it is always good to keep this sense of doing the next right thing, right now, keeping in mind the limits on law's power to foster change and your own fidelity to the larger goal. So, and then I go on to quote from two plays that I wrote, one about the trial of the colonial editor John Peter Zenger, and another about Sterrow and Lucy Parsons. Both of those plays ask this question, and you can go to the University of Texas Rappaport, Rappoport Center, and see a performance of a part of those plays as well as other things.
I wanted to follow up on that about the play that you wrote on the Haymarket tragedy, where the anarchist leader Lucy Parsons mocks Clarence Darrow, saying, she said to him, quote, "Your lawyer's victories, Clarence, are like fireflies. You catch them and put them in a jar, and by morning their light has gone out, and your bugs are dead." What do you say to that argument that she used against the law, that she says the law really doesn't matter?
Well, the debate continues. What Darrow says is that the law is a fence built around the people and their rights. And it is his job as a lawyer is to build, construct, defend that fence. A true answer would be a long one. If you read some of Darrow's jury speeches, you know that he was always imbued with a sense of history. And indeed, I've been thinking today about the Chauvin trial, the trial of that police officer. The lawyers for the prosecution cannot succeed in that case unless they acknowledge their own racism and ask the jurors to acknowledge that they, too, are imbued with this stain of racism, and to confront that they'll have to confront it. That's what Darrow did in the Ossian Sweet trial, and that's what jurors have to do today. What Lucy Parsons is saying is, well, I'm not so sure the law matters. Look what it did. And what Darrow is saying is, well, I've spent my life acting as if it did, and trying to ameliorate where I could.
Elaborate a bit, would you please, Michael, on the Ossian Sweet trial? I think it's really important for our listeners to understand what happened there.
In the 1920s, a dentist, Dr. Ossian Sweet, moved into an all-white neighborhood in Detroit. The local white citizens groups tried to chase him out, and there were rocks thrown, there was a gun battle, and in the course of it, there was a shooting. And Dr. Sweet and his whole family were indicted for an alleged conspiracy to kill. The case was tried. Darrow was retained by the NAACP to be lead counsel. And there was an acquittal. It was more than one trial. You can read about it, as a matter of fact, in a great book called Trial Stories, which you can order online from Foundation Press. That's the short version. But what Darrow did in that case was first stand up to the jury and say, "I am a racist. I've got racial prejudice. Every one of you members of the jury has it, and you're not being truthful to yourselves if you think you don't." To get them to acknowledge the fact that they too were imbued with racial prejudice. Darrow's conduct of the case was magnificent. This is just another illustration that if we are, as lawyers, to confront racism, we're going to have to do it by acknowledging our own limitations and by being out front to demand that judges, jurors, police, and others acknowledge their own inbred racism that is the product of their social, political, and historical conditioning. That we don't see things as they are. We see them as we are. And I acknowledge, you know, for example, I'm racially prejudiced. If I'm walking by Goldman Sachs and a white guy comes out, I cross the street because he might come and steal, he might steal my pension. And I know that that's a racial image, but I can't get over it.
Michael, what would you like readers of your book to take away from it, given what seem to be such terrible, yet also hopeful times that we're living through right now?
Now, when have the times been other than what you just said? I went to South Africa in 1987 to work with the Black Lawyers Association and the African National Congress, helping to train lawyers. And people were saying, yeah, we're going to make some change over here. We're going to get Mandela out and so on. And I said, well, yeah, I've seen the guns and the dogs and the rest. These folks had lived in an apartheid situation for 30 years under situations of brutal oppression. And yet every day, those active in the movement, millions of people, thousands of people, woke up and said, okay, what can I do today to try to bring about change? And when we see examples like that, I think that we have reason to say, you know what? There is an arc of history. If we try to understand the roots of the repression that we are seeing, then we can take the steps that are necessary to try to make change. We are in no different a situation in having to make those kinds of decisions than anyone at any time confronted with issues of moment in the context of American history.
Beautifully said, Michael Tiger. We've been speaking with Michael Tiger, whose magnificent memoir, Sensing Injustice, A Lawyer's Life and the Battle for Change, has just been published by Monthly Review. You can get it at monthlyreview.org. We urge you to read it. This book, along with Michael Ratner's memoir, I think are essential for any not only any young lawyer or law student, but for anybody interested in social change who's fighting in the movement. Michael, Heidi and I are most grateful for your taking an hour and allowing us to interview. Sensing Injustice, a wonderful book. We urge all of you to get it.
My privilege. Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.